Okay, good morning. This is September 26th, Monday, and we're going to start talking about muscles, the introductory chapter on muscles. And can anybody remember what a muscle is specialized to do? What does a muscle do in your body? It contracts, that's right, it shortens, right? And it can generate tension when it contracts. So we're going to start looking at that today, some microscopic structure. But before we start talking about muscle, which is, I think, chapter 10 in your textbook, I just want to remind people what the schedule is. So this week, you have practicums on bones. And after you're done with your practicum, don't forget all your bones, because you still have the lecture test, which is 1 week from today. And I don't have that date. Does anybody have that date handy? October 3rd is a week from today. Yeah, so you have that lecture exam. And there'll be a few more questions on that exam compared to what was on the first one. So maybe not quite 100, but what was on the first one? 80, so maybe 90, 95, something like that. But you should still have plenty of time to complete that exam. All right, so the point is, don't forget your bones after the practicum, because you have the lecture test. But even more importantly, even after the lecture test, don't forget your bones, because it's going to be important when we talk about muscles and then a whole bunch of other structures too, the nervous system and cardiovascular system. Bones will still be important through the rest of the class. So when you're done with those tests, maybe take 15 minutes or a half hour and just go over some of the study materials that you looked at, just to keep all those bones fresh in your mind. All right, so practicums this week. So don't be late to your lab period, because that will really mix up your schedule. All right, so anybody have any questions over bones? Yes? Okay, your SI leader is not currently here, so I don't know. Okay, so you have a practical test, but you're actually asking, is there a practice test for the lecture? And I'm sure she has that available, but I don't know when that's scheduled. All right, so we got one today and Wednesday that says practice practical exam. So you're really welcome to give her an email and just say, hey, don't forget about the lecture test coming up on Monday. Maybe you could work both of those in. Okay, so I'm sure she'd be able to pull that together with very little effort, because she's done it before. Okay. That's the SI leader. All right, so let's talk about muscle. This is sort of an interesting part of the class, because now you're just not learning the names of static structures, but you're going to learn something about your body that can be put into motion. And motion and videos are much more exciting than just still pictures. So this is kind of fun. So let's talk about the functions of skeletal muscle. Number one, movement. Skeletal muscle is a kind of muscle that attaches bones together. It's a bone-to-bone kind of attachment. And so when a muscle contracts, it can move bones around inside your body. And when bones move in the right coordinated fashion, that allows you to move through your environment. All right? But it's even more important than that. Because right now, you're not running around. You're just sitting in one position, sitting still. And, of course, if all the muscles in your body were to relax at this point in time, what would happen to you, even though you're not exercising? What are muscles important for? Just maintaining posture, right? So that you're sitting in that chair, you still require muscles so that your head doesn't hit the table, bonk. Right, and if you were to relax completely, not only would your head hit the table, it would bounce, and then hit the chair, bounce, bounce, and then hit the floor, bounce, bounce. Right, so that's not good. So muscles are important, even for keeping you steady, keeping you still. We call that posture. All right, something else muscles are important for is joint stabilization. Certain joints have only certain allowed kinds of motions, like the joints between your digits. In your phalanges, or the joints between phalanges and a digit, what kind of joint is that? And what, it's just a nice simple hinge joint, so it allows for flexion and extension. What were to happen if all of a sudden you tried to abduct or adduct a joint? Yeah, you would break a phalange, okay, or phalanx when that were to happen. So muscles protect joints. So joint stabilization is very important function. And as a matter of fact, if a joint ever does get damaged, right, through some kind of trauma, what is really the only thing that you can do as an owner of that joint do to get that joint functioning again properly? And that is to really use the muscles that work across that joint, exercise the muscles, and that will then stabilize the joint. Like if you injure a knee, the best way to stabilize that knee is to work on muscles of the thigh and of the leg, okay, that work across the knee. All right, and another function then is to generate body heat. So what can you tell me about your body temperature? Does it go up and down? Maybe a little bit, but what should it typically be? About 98.6 degrees. Maybe it goes up a little bit, but as soon as it starts going up, something in you changes. What happens? You start to sweat, you lose body heat, and then when you're cold, what happens? You start to shiver, and those muscles that are causing that shivering increase your body temperature. So one way to maintain a constant temperature in your body when you get too cold is through muscle contraction. All right, and it's important for you to maintain pretty much a constant temperature right around that 98 degrees. And anything high or low is going to be called hyperthermia or hypothermia, and that's a disease state. We can't function very far away from 98 degrees. All right, so what are some special functional characteristics that separate muscle tissue from other tissues in your body? Some special properties include contractility. If things are going to contract or shorten in your body, then they're going to require muscle proteins. Even inside of a cell, right, there aren't muscles inside of a cell, but there are still proteins that make muscle up that cause things to contract even with inside of a cell. Excitability, that means that under most circumstances, maybe a muscle will be flaccid, but it can be stimulated into contracting, so it is excitable. So muscles can change state. They can go from a relaxed state to a contracted state, and therefore it is excitable. It's under different kinds of control. Different muscles are controlled differently. Extensibility, right? Muscles not only can shorten when they're excited, they can contract with power, they can generate tension, but muscles can also stretch. And so that's what we mean by extensibility. So once a muscle contracts, then it can be stretched back to its original length. And that's going to be really important. If you consider the biceps brachii, which is in your anterior arm, right, when that muscle contracts, it causes, what's this motion right here that I'm undergoing? Flexion at the elbow or flexion of the forearm, different ways of talking about that. All right, but there's an antagonistic muscle that's undergoing a different kind of motion. Where would we find an antagonist to this biceps right here? Look in the opposite body compartment, which is going to be the posterior arm. And so when the biceps contracts, there's a muscle in the posterior arm that has to stretch out, and that's the triceps. And when the triceps contracts, causing extension of the forearm, then the biceps has to then stretch back out. Right? So muscles are extensible. And then the last thing, muscles are also elastic. And what does that mean? If we stretch a muscle out and let go, what happens? It has a tendency to go back to its natural length automatically all by itself. All right, so think of these four different characteristics of muscle. All right, now, there are different kinds of muscles in your body. And the major classes, we see that there's only three right here. We got skeletal, cardiac, and smooth muscle. And I think maybe we talk about what these look like underneath the microscope. Probably here is a nice slide that shows some of the histology of what these different muscles look like. But you should know some of the characteristics of these three different kinds of muscle. All right, skeletal muscle is long, all right, and it's unbranched. So it's just a long fiber. And it can be, a foot long, for instance, and the cell typically is, very short to where you need a microscope to see it. And the reason why skeletal muscle is really long is because at one point in time, it was made up of hundreds or maybe even thousands of individual cells that fused together to make this big, long fiber. So A skeletal muscle and a muscle fiber can be used synonymously. Muscle fiber and a skeletal muscle cell are really the same thing. And because those cells fuse together to form this long, straight fiber, all of the nuclei from those individual cells remain within the muscle fiber. So this is kind of a strange cell because it's macroscopically long, but it also is multinucleated. So here's a cell that has many, many nuclei in them, and that's a skeletal muscle cell. When you look at this slide right here, there should be something that stands out besides the long linear nature of this fiber. But what else stands out? All these stripes that you see kind of look like zebra stripes, and of course we call these things striations. We're going to find out why these striations are inside a skeletal muscle cell today. Another real important thing is that skeletal muscle is under voluntary control. It needs to be innervated by a part of your nervous system that we call the somatic motor nervous system, which is under your conscious control. So your conscious thought then sends electrical signals to these muscles to get them to contract or relax in the right kind of way for your proper motion. All right, so we call skeletal muscle voluntary muscle. And as a matter of fact, this is kind of freaky. Of all the things that your nervous system controls in your body, and all of the different functions that are performed in your body, skeletal muscle is the only thing that you have conscious control of. So everything else is under autonomic control or automatic control. So your digestive system, your heart, your respirations, and things like that are controlled by your autonomic nervous system. All right, so why do we call this skeletal muscle? Because it's attached to your skeleton. Okay, that's a really nice, simple reason. So it's attached to your skeleton, and you can cause your skeleton to do whatever you want, right? If you're thirsty and you want to pick up a glass of water, you can cause those muscles to contract to lift up that glass of water. Has it ever happened that when you told those muscles to contract, they reported back to you and said, no, we're not going to pick up that glass of water because we're not thirsty? They never said that to you, right? Because they're voluntary muscles. They can't make up their own mind. Like other parts of your body can ignore your conscious thought and deal with your body. Okay, one of those kinds of muscles, here it is cardiac muscle, which is on the next slide right here. And you can see that it has some similarities to skeletal muscle. Namely, what stands out right away? Striations, yeah. That means that the internal machinery inside cardiac muscle is similar to skeletal muscle, okay? But the difference is that it's not connected to the somatic nervous system, it's just connected to the autonomic nervous system, so it's not voluntary muscle. So do you have control over your heart? You do not, right? Your autonomic nervous system does. You can influence your heart rate and force of contraction a little bit, maybe through different kinds of meditations or things that you hear by accident, right, can inadvertently make minor modifications to your heart, but basically you can't stop your heart or change its rhythm just by thinking like you can with a skeletal muscle. And maybe I've done this before in one of the first classes that we had. Like right now I could say, okay, put all your books away, we're going to have a pop quiz over bones just to get you ready for the practicum today. Okay, so what happened to your heart rate when you heard that? It probably elevated a little bit, probably sped up, all right? So there are different tricks you can do to help manipulate your heart rate, but it's not under conscious control. Now, these cells, we don't call fibers because they're not long, straight cells, right? They're very short. So for instance, here is a cell between these two dark lines. And these dark lines are what we call intercalated discs. So this cell goes from one intercalated disc to another. Here's another one down over here, from here to here. All right, now these cells of the heart should all contract together. So this is an important feature, the intercalated discs, because the cells are short, they should all contract together. These cells shouldn't pull apart from each other. So in these intercalated discs, there are special junctions that glue the ends of these cells together so that they don't separate. Physical connections. All right, the other thing is that there's a special kind of synapse or a communication between these two cells so that when one cell is told to contract, that signal moves into the next cell and the next cell and the next cell, so As long as one cell in the heart is told to contract, what happens to the whole heart? It contracts together as a unit, right? Which is real important. And those things, those little junctions between individual cells in this intercalated disc are called gap junctions. So gap junctions allow electrical signals to pass from one cell to the other so that when one cell is told to contract, the whole heart contracts. And that's important because what is the heart doing when it contracts? It's pumping blood, right? And in order for the heart to pump blood, the whole heart has to contract, not just one part of it. Because if one part contracts, then blood is just going to squish to some other part of the heart instead of your body. So gap junctions allow the whole heart to contract in unison. Now, would it be a good idea for skeletal muscle to have intercalated discs with gap junctions? Not a really good idea. And the reason is because if all skeletal muscle had gap junctions, if you told one muscle to contract, what would happen to all the muscles in your body? They would contract as well. Instead of reaching for a glass of water, what would happen to your body? Just total spasm, right? You wouldn't be able to reach a glass of water. So that would not be helpful. The other thing is you'd never be able to leave class either since you're here. Every time you got up to stand, what would happen? You'd just contract and you'd be stuck here forever. So gap junctions are not good for skeletal muscles, but great for cardiac muscle. Okay, so again, since these cells are short, they're not derived from hundreds of progenitor cells. Each one of these cells only have one nucleus in them, unlike skeletal muscle, which is what? Multinucleated. All right, but the internal machinery is going to be very much the same. And what kind of control is cardiac muscle under? Involuntary control. All right, then we move on to smooth muscle over here. Smooth muscle has a different internal apparatus for contraction. It still has the same kinds of proteins, and we're going to see that those are actin and myosin molecules, right? But their arrangement is totally different, so I don't see any striations in smooth muscle. And these are not long cylindrical cells like in skeletal. They kind of look like a football that's been stretched out. It has two pointy ends right here. They're more fusiform. A fusiform shape is when you have a long, narrow shape with two pointy ends, kind of like a fish or like maybe a whale or a porpoise, something like that. And again, only one nucleus. These you can't get to contract by your conscious thought, although it'd be really helpful under certain circumstances if that could happen. This kind of muscle lines the walls of hollow organs inside your body, like reproductive tract, respiratory tract, digestive tract. And when these muscles go into spasm, it hurts just like when a skeletal muscle goes into spasm. Have you ever had a muscle cramp? Maybe you're walking down the street. Maybe you're walking down the street and all of a sudden you get a cramp in your biceps brachii, right? And it contracts. Right, and how does that feel when that biceps contracts because there's maybe damage to the nerve or to the muscle right there? It's no longer under your conscious control to get it to relax. What do you do? Do you like show that big massive muscle off to all your friends and say, "Ooh, are you impressed with this big muscle?" Or what are you doing when that muscle contracts? You're kind of jumping around, hyperventilating, contracting different muscles in your body, doing everything you can imagine to do what? To get that muscle to relax, because how does that muscle feel when it's in that tonic state of contraction? It hurts like hell, right? And that's going to be the same for any of these muscles right here. Cardiac muscle, when it's not receiving oxygen, hurts like hell. Smooth muscle, when it goes into contraction, hurts like hell. So that's something else that all of these muscles share in common. So anytime these muscles go into contraction, like maybe if you're in the part of your urinary system, if you have a kidney stone and it causes contraction of a ureter, for instance, then that's going to hurt really, really bad. You'll be doing anything to get that pain to go away. Or other parts, reproductive system, for instance. Like one might be a circumstance you could think of in your reproductive system when these muscles go into spasm. Like during parturition, for instance. All right, because these muscles go into tonic contraction, those contractions are very painful. So I'm told, and I can imagine. All right, so these are not branched. What kind of cells of these three right here are branched? There's only one, and that's cardiac muscle. And I think I forgot to mention that point, and that is because the heart has to contract as a unit, not just from end to end, but also from this superior region to this deep region, or superficial to deep region, because how does that electrical signal go? Not just from side to side, but because these cells are branched, it can travel down through all of these branches to excite the whole wall of the heart at one time. All right, so those are the three kinds of muscles and some details about them. All right, so now we're going to pay really more attention just to skeletal muscle and use that as a model to understand how other kinds of muscle works in your body. Okay, so let's take a look at some skeletal muscle. I think this is a pretty good exam figure right here that we've got. All right, so we see some gross anatomy. Oh, like what bone is this right here? Am I giving away anything on the practicum? I can't tell. Can't remember. But what bone does this look like to you? A nice femur, right? So I see the greater trochanter, lesser trochanter right here. So here is a muscle that is in your thigh. And there is a muscle-to-bone connection, which is dense regular connective tissue that we call a tendon. And so that's what attaches this muscle to this particular bone. And there is an extension of that connective tissue that surrounds the whole muscle. So here is the whole muscle, and that's called the epimysium. Mesium just means muscle membrane, and epi means on top of, right? And it's continuous with the tendon. All right, and then if we look inside this muscle, is it all homogeneous, or do we see structures inside the muscle? We see some structures. We see little muscle bundles. Each one of these little bundles right here is what we call a fascicle. Right, and then surrounding every fascicle is some more connective tissue, so that when this fascicle contracts, it pulls on that connective tissue, which then pulls on the epimysium, which then pulls on the tendon, which then pulls on what? The bone, right? So it all pulls together. So that connective tissue around every fascicle is called the perimysium. And then let's pull a fascicle out. Do you see more structures inside of a fascicle? Yeah, and indeed there are. There are some structures, and each of these structures inside of a fascicle is a muscle fiber. You see this big, long fiber? So now we're at a microscopic level. We've changed scales of this illustration. We can see striations. So here is a muscle fiber or muscle cell. Besides lots of striations, what do you see a lot of in here? What are these blue things? These are nuclei, right? Because this is one of those funny kind of cells that is what? Multinucleate. All right, so the building block of a fascicle is a muscle cell. What's another name for a muscle cell? A muscle fiber. Yeah, right here. All right, and then there is, around every muscle cell or muscle fiber, there's another connective tissue sheath that we call the endomysium. And the endomysium is continuous with the perimysium, which is continuous with the epimysium, which continues on and attaches to the tendon. So when this cell contracts and pulls on the endomysium, what does it do? It pulls on the perimysium and then the epimysium and then it pulls on the tendon, and that generates a lot of tension on this particular bone right here. Right? So they all converge together. All right, so I want you to know the different layers of organization of a muscle. All right, so here is a muscle. And this could be like one of the hamstring muscles in your posterior thigh. And so what is the building block of this whole muscle right here? It is a fascicle. And what's used to put a fascicle together? Muscle cells or muscle fibers. So muscle fibers can be used, right, as a building block for a fascicle. We put fascicles together and we get a whole muscle that's inside your body. All right, so know the different connective tissues that surrounds these different structures. And if we look at a muscle cell or a muscle fiber on the inside, what do we see? Is it all homogeneous? We see more structures like striations and even these little bundles right here. So I do want you to know what these little bundles are called. All right, these bundles are called fascicles. The bundles inside of a fascicle are called cells. And then these bundles inside of a cell are what we call myofibrils. So let me see if I can find a picture of a myofibril someplace. Here's a pretty good picture. All right, so we're looking at just one muscle fiber right here, or muscle cell. So let's pull that out from everything else. And this is what we got. So here's a muscle cell. And a muscle cell has what? Many nuclei. And right here is the cell membrane of this cell. Sometimes we call that the sarcolemma. The sarcolemma is just another name for the cell membrane of a muscle cell. And then here are all those little tubes that we saw on that previous slide. And interspersed between these tubes are mitochondria. A lot of mitochondria. So what would you guess the requirement of this muscle cell is for whatever job the mitochondria is doing? What is the job of mitochondria, once again? To make ATP. Would you guess that a muscle cell needs a lot of ATP? Indeed it does. That's why they're in here. All right, so here is another organelle that you didn't really learn when we looked at organelles. It's specific to skeletal muscle cells, and it's called a myofibril. It's made of special kinds of proteins with a certain kind of arrangement that produces all these striations right here. And this is the structural and functional unit of contraction, is the myofibril. All right, so this thing contracts, and guess what? All of these myofibrils contract together when this muscle cell is told to contract. So let's talk about these striations right here. I see some dark bands, and then that's followed by a light band, which is followed by a dark band, which is followed by a light band. And it just so happens that we named these bands. This dark band is called the A band, and the light band is called an I band. So I do want you to know something about these different bands in here. And it's really handy. It's not really hard to remember, because what is the vowel in dark? What's the vowel? D is a consonant, but what's the vowel in the word dark? A. And what's the name of that band right there? A band. That's not really why it was named that way, okay? It was named because of the way light passes through a muscle cell. But at least it's handy to remember. And it also works for the I band, because what's the vowel in the word light? It's an I, right? So it's really easy to remember. All right, and one follows the other all the way from one end of the muscle cell to the other. And as a matter of fact, if we were to line up a bunch of muscle fibers together, like put hundreds of them down below this one, all of these bands would line up as well. So it's very easy to see these striations underneath a light microscope. All right, so if we take a bunch of these muscle fibers and put them together, what do we get? What do we get? A muscle fiber is a building block of what? Look back at one of those previous slides while I take a quick break. It makes a fascicle. And if we put a bunch of fascicles together, what do we get? Then you get a muscle, like the biceps brachii or a hamstring. All right, so a muscle fiber is a building block for a fascicle. Now, what's the building block of a muscle fiber? It is this myofibril right here. All right, so I want you to be able to move up and down that structural organization of a muscle. So you're probably interested in to know, well, what the heck is making up all those structures inside the myofibril? Don't forget, the myofibril is the organ of contraction. Organelle of contraction. All right, so we talked about all of this so far. Okay, we're down to B. All right, but let's continue looking at this myofibril. So again, if we put a bunch of these myofibrils together, what do we get? A fiber. Yeah, that's right. Okay, and here we can see a light band right here. What's the name of a light band? The I band. And then here is a dark band, right? And that's called the A band. And there is something right here that forms a zigzagged line, right here and right here, and we call that the Z disc. This is the beginning and the end point of how this muscle, this myofibril contracts. And so from Z disc to Z disc, there is something that we call a sarcomere. So sarcomere is a dark, the A band right in the middle, and on the ends we have parts of two I bands right here. So let's look at some components that make up this sarcomere. These dark lines right here, these are thick proteins, so they block a lot of light. So sometimes we call these thick filaments. Right? And the name of a thick filament is called a myosin molecule. So here's a myosin molecule that's a thick filament. And then what about, and that looks red to me, what about this blue line right here? Does that look thick? That looks thin. And as a matter of fact, it's called a thin filament. And the name of the protein that makes a thin filament is called actin. So there are two main kinds of proteins that fill up a sarcomere. There are thick ones that are myosin and thin ones that we call actin. And the myosin molecules are kind of held right in the middle of the sarcomere by this M line right here. And between the ends of these actin molecules, around that M line is what we call the H zone. It's kind of an intermediate density. It's not quite light, it's not quite dark. It's kind of in between. All right, so what are the endpoints of a sarcomere? When you look at this slide right here, conceptually I would like for you to see that. What are the endpoints? The endpoints are the Z disc. So here is sarcomere outline, and that points right to the Z disc. That's one end of a sarcomere, and on the other end you have the other Z disc. So just think that's the last letter of the alphabet for you to remember. And it's the sarcomere that's actually going to contract, and when it does, these Z discs are going to approximate each other, which means that they're going to come closer to each other. So we're going to be interested to find out which one of these proteins that we talked about so far, either the myosin, the actin, which ones of these actually contract or shorten when the sarcomere shortens. And the sarcomere right here, this is where all the action is. In order to understand why a whole muscle like the biceps contracts, all we have to do is understand why the sarcomere shortens. Okay, or why does the sarcomere contract? So the structural and functional unit of contraction in all skeletal muscle is the sarcomere, right? And what is a myofibril made up of? One sarcomere followed by another one and another one and another one and another one and another one, all the way from one end of the muscle fiber to the other. Okay. All right, so we're going to talk about that in just a second. When we talk about muscles in general, okay, let me see if I have a picture. I might not have a really good picture of this. Oh, here's a pretty good picture. Okay. Here's a muscle that's contracting. This one right here kind of looks like the biceps brachii, but it's a little bit different one. It's called the brachialis. All right, but here is the bone in your arm. What's the bone in your arm called? The humerus. And then here are some bones in your forearm. Right, and which one is the medial one, which is this one right here? Here's the ulna, that's the medial one, and the lateral one is the radius. Well, this muscle goes from the humerus down to the ulna, right? So it goes across the elbow joint. And what kind of muscle, oh, it says brachialis right here, nice. All right, when a muscle is excited, right, what can it do? It contract. Can it ever push on anything? It can't really push. It can't expand with power. It can only contract, developing tension. So when this muscle is excited, it gets shorter, so it's going to pull the ulna up toward the humerus. And what do we call that motion? That's flexion. Okay. All right, so some definitions about muscles. So most muscles have two ends, and they're given different names depending on what the action of that muscle is. What action is produced when the muscle does what? When it contracts, when it gets shorter. So I see one end up over here on the humerus and the other is down on the ulna. And of the two bones that we have right here, the humerus and the ulna, when this muscle contracts, which one moves more? Is it the ulna or the humerus? It's the ulna that moves. All right, so by definition, the end of the muscle that produces the most motion, which is the one that is attaching to the ulna, we call that the insertion. the bone that moves very little, right? Or the end of the muscle that's attached to the bone that moves very little, that's what we call the origin. So every muscle has an origin and insertion depending on the motion that's produced. So this brachialis, the origin is going to be the humerus, and the insertion is going to be the ulna down over here, causing the forearm to flex. All right, so the less movable end of a muscle is the origin, and the more movable end of the muscle is called the insertion. The muscles that you have to know are going to be in your lab list, and in lab we'll show you where to find all of that. All right, there's also the attachment point, okay? The attachment, a muscle to bone attachment, all right? So here's the muscle and here's the bone, is this like white material right here, and that's what we call a tendon, right? A muscle to bone connection is a tendon. And I can see this tendon is really long compared to this one over here. So this is called more like a direct attachment, right? If there's a long tendon, then that's an indirect attachment because the tendon is really long. And sometimes we're actually going to call this tendon, if it's very broad, an aponeurosis or an aponeurotica. So a broad flat tendonous sheath is called an aponeurosis. All right, so that's just some gross anatomy. All right, we're talking about the microscopic anatomy. Let's continue talking about some microscopic anatomy right here. Now that we know something about origin insertion. All right, so let's look into this myofibril in a little bit more detail. And as a matter of fact, if we look on the side of a myofibril, I see some dots. What do these dots represent? What about this one right here? Here's a big dot. That's a thick filament. Right? Sometimes we call that a myofilament. What's the name of this thick myofilament? It is myosin. Right? And what about this one over here? Yeah, that's an actin myofilament. And what's another name for an actin myofilament? It's a thin filament, right? So you got thick and thin. Now, what can you tell me about the arrangement of these different filaments? So here's a thick filament. What is it completely surrounded by? Do you see that little pattern right there? What's it surrounded by? It's surrounded completely by thin filaments, something you don't see in just this two-dimensional diagram right here. But every myosin is surrounded by actin molecules. And conversely, what is this actin filament surrounded by? Thick filaments. So they kind of surround each other. So there's going to be a special interaction between these different filaments based on their arrangement that we see inside the cell. All right, so don't forget about that three-dimensional structure. So let's jump back to just a two-dimensional diagram. And again, we have a Z line over here, or a Z disk, and a Z disk over here. And so what's all this junk between the Z disks called once again? That's the sarcomere. All right, so that's the structural and functional unit of contraction inside of a muscle. So you know what? I don't like this diagram that I see in this book right here, because what about this sarcomere? Where should these lines be drawn? Should go all the way over to the Z-disc, and it should go all the way over to this Z-disc right here, right? So make sure if your book has this picture in it, you correct it. I'd never noticed that. Maybe it's a new edition where that's in. So it goes from Z-disc to Z-disc is the sarcomere. All right, the thick filaments are the myosin. The thin are the actin. Here's that M-line that I was talking about that holds the myosin molecules in position. And then I see these little springy-like molecules here and here that help stabilize the myosin molecule, that help attach it to a Z-disc. But these right here really can't produce tension. But when you stretch them out and let go, what happens to a spring? It produces elasticity within a sarcomere. So these things are what we call titin molecules or titin proteins. So you got actin and myosin, which are for active contraction, and then you have titin right here for the elastic properties of a sarcomere.
Still a little tickle. Okay, let's see if I can go on here. Okay, so the question I posed was, which ones of these proteins actually shorten because these sarcomeres are actually going to come together? So could anybody guess actin or myosin? Or both, I guess, could be another answer. Okay. So let's see. Let me get to this picture right here. Okay, so here we see two sarcomeres. Don't forget, a sarcomere goes from Z to Z. And then over here on the right, these aren't connected together. This is a different picture. There's a Z line and a Z line over here. And in this particular case, this is a fully relaxed sarcomere. So if we could measure the distance from Z line to Z line, we would see that it's a fairly long distance. But what about the distance now from the Z line here to over here when the sarcomere is contracted? Can you see that this distance here to here is shorter than from here to here? Can you kind of buy into that? Can you see that this is long and this is short? So the sarcomere on the right-hand side is actually shortening or contracting as a result. All right, so let's use this illustration to find out what proteins are actually contracting. Let's look at this actin molecule, okay, and compare it to its length over here. Can anybody tell me what's the change in length of this actin molecule? It looks like it's the same, right? So if in your book, take a ruler out and actually measure it, and you should see that it looks the same. All right, so what kind of protein is this actin again? It's the thin filament. And where is this actin connected? Is it connected to this M line right here, or is it connected to the Z disc? It's connected to the Z disc, right? All right, so what's the other protein we're interested in? Is the myosin molecule, right, or the thick filament. So let's compare the length of the thick filament when the sarcomere is relaxed compared to when it's contracted. Anybody have a sense of what the length of this myosin is here compared to what it is right here? It looks like it's actually the same. All right, so in this particular case, we see that actin is the same length and the myosin is the same length, but the Z discs have come together. How is that possible? And it's actually pretty ingenious once you see it. Okay, so let's look at these two markers that I have right here. One could be the myosin and the other could be the actin. When the muscle is relaxed, the actin and myosin hardly overlap each other at all. All right, but when the muscle is told to contract, the actin and myosin now start to slide over each other. And when they slide over each other, what happens to the total length of the sarcomere? It got shorter. But what about the lengths of these individual proteins? Did they change at all? No, because the markers stay exactly the same length. They just did what? They just slid over each other. All right, so that is the model that I want you to have in your mind. It's called the sliding filament model for muscle contraction. So when a muscle contracts, what proteins actually shorten inside of the muscle cell or inside the sarcomere? You would say, there aren't any proteins that shorten. You would say that the sarcomere shortens because these actin and myosin molecules do what? They slide over each other. And so that is the sliding filament mechanism. All right, so let's compare what we see right here. What are these light bands called again? I see some light bands. These are the I bands. What happens to the I bands when it contracts? That actually, they shorten or almost go away completely. Okay, and the dark band stays the same length. So typically you might see some questions like that. What band goes away during contraction? And that is the I band. Also, this intermediate band, the H band, goes away as well. But notice for sure these light bands go away because what happens to the light band? What is the light band? It's this area right here that only has actin filaments in it. But when the muscle is contracted, do you find any part of the sarcomere that only has actin? Not really. Only these tiny, tiny little tips right here. Most have a complete overlap of actin and myosin molecules right here. Okay, so this is a nice sliding filament mechanism for muscle contraction. This is when it's relaxed. Here's when it's contracted. Okay. So that's what this says right here. Okay, so how is it that a skeletal muscle is under voluntary control? That means that there has to be electrical signals that come from a nerve fiber that tell the skeletal muscle to contract. So here is a nerve cell, and this nerve cell we call a motor neuron, because what is this neuron going to do? It's going to cause some kind of motion, right? And what do you use to cause motion in your car? It's the motor, right? So motor is causing motion. Anytime you think of some kind of motor activity in your body, it's going to cause some kind of motion. So there's an electrical signal that comes down this neuron right here, and this neuron is attached in different places to the muscle cell. And these are what we're going to call the neuromuscular junction. So there's a neuromuscular junction right here. And does that make perfect sense? Because it's a junction between what? A neuron and a muscle cell. And there's electrical activity coming down the neuron. But I see a space, if we zoom into this region right here, I see a space between the neuron and the muscle cell. So the electrical signal can't jump across this space because then there would be like a little lightning bolt right through here or some kind of static electricity. And you don't have that kind of stuff occurring inside your body. So how is it that an electrical signal in a neuron can cause this muscle cell to contract? And that's because the information that's electrical inside the neuron is converted into a chemical signal that then moves across this synaptic cleft, which is the space between the neuron and the muscle. And when that chemical binds to the membrane of the muscle cell, that causes another electrical signal to develop on the muscle cell. So let's follow that train of thought once again. So what's the nature of the signal coming down a neuron? Is it electrical or chemical? It's an electrical signal. And then as it jumps from the neuron to the muscle through the synaptic cleft right here, the space between the cells, what's the nature of that signal? It's a chemical signal, right? And then what's the signal that causes the muscle to contract? That chemical signal causes another electrical signal to flow over the whole muscle cell very rapidly. And that's why, for instance, when you shock yourself by accident, maybe you grabbed a toaster cord or something that had some of the insulation breaking away from it. What happens to muscles when you get an electric shock? They contract, right? So that electrical signal flows over the muscle, all the muscles in your body, causing them to contract. All right, so this kind of synapse is what we call a chemical synapse. Right, we looked at an electrical synapse previously in cardiac muscle cells, which is a way for electrical signals to jump from one cell directly to another cell in cardiac muscle through those gap junctions. but there are no gap junctions at the neuromuscular junction. So in this little swelling at the end of a neuron, which is what we call a synaptic terminus or axon terminus, it's filled with little vesicles. You see these little vesicles right here that have the signaling molecule inside of them. These are what we call neurotransmitters. Because what's the name of the cell that's going to be transmitting that chemical? It's a neuron. So we call that a neurotransmitter. The electrical signal comes down, causes the fusion of this vesicle to the membrane right here. These particles are exocytosed into the synaptic cleft, and then they just diffuse from high concentration to low concentration across the synaptic cleft. And so that's a neurotransmitter. The neurotransmitter that's used at all neuromuscular junctions everywhere in your body is called acetylcholine. Where is it here? Acetylcholine or acetylcholine. So that's the neurotransmitter. That's not used exclusively by all neurons, but by all motor neurons it is. All right, so acetylcholine, which is a specific kind of neurotransmitter, bumps up against the cell membrane of the muscle cell. What did we call the cell membrane of a muscle cell? That's a sarcolemma right here. And it's going to start another electrical signal. And the way that it does that is that acetylcholine has to bind to a particular molecule within the neuromuscular junction that we call, the receptor. So there's got to be a receptor for acetylcholine, which then starts that electrical signal that flows over the whole cell. Let's look at the next slide. I think we need just a little bit, oh, there's a nice one, a little bit more anatomy. here's where I want to go. Okay, so here is the sarcolemma of the cell. And here we see a bunch of tubes that fill up the muscle fiber. What are these little tubes called? These are the organelles for contraction. These are myofibrils, right? So, and we put a bunch of myofibrils together. What do we get? The whole muscle fiber, right? And if we put a bunch of muscle fibers together, what do we get? A fascicle. We put a bunch of fascicles together, then we get a whole muscle, like a biceps. All right, so we're now looking at a nice zoomed-in region of this whole muscle cell right here with the different myofibrils inside of it. And here's the sarcolemma. Here is some endoplasmic reticulum. And does this endoplasmic reticulum look like rough or smooth? It's smooth, all right? So when you think the function of this endoplasmic reticulum is protein synthesis, would you say yes or no? I see people shaking their head no, because why? Then it would be rough ER, not smooth ER. The function of this particular smooth endoplasmic reticulum that does what? Surrounds all of the myofibrils, see completely surrounding a myofibril right here, is that it stores an ion, and that ion is calcium. So the smooth ER in skeletal muscle cells stores calcium, and as a matter of fact, it takes it out of solution from around all these myofilaments right here. It's actually actively pumped in using ATP to pump it into these sacs right here. And that calcium inside the sarcoplasmic reticulum, which is the smooth endoplasmic reticulum in a skeletal muscle cell, is used to cause the myosin and actin filaments to slide over each other. So when calcium is in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, the muscle is relaxed. But when calcium leaks out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, the filaments slide over each other. So let's look and see how that can happen. All right, so we were at the neuromuscular junction, and we said that acetylcholine can cause an electrical signal on the cell membrane, and it's going to flow over the cell membrane of the cell. But not only that, that electrical signal can get deep down into the interior of the muscle fiber and actually surround each of these myofibrils. Do you see a pathway where an electrical signal, that's kind of trapped on the sarcolemma, how can it reach the interior of the muscle cell? Because, maybe you see the color right here, is this the same color as the sarcolemma? This is what we call a transverse tubule or a T-tubule. And because this is what, transverse to the long axis of a muscle cell, so that electrical signal gets to this T-tubule, it not only continues on its way, but it splits up and it moves down the T-tubule. And what is the T-tubule right next to? The sarcoplasmic reticulum. So when the electrical signal moves through the T-tubule around the sarcoplasmic reticulum, it opens up all the floodgates and it allows calcium to flood through the myofibril, and that's going to be the signal for sliding of filaments past each other. All right, so before you took this class, where did you learn it was important to have good calcium levels in your body? For bones. Because why? What does it make bones? It makes bones strong. Okay? But now you learn another important place where calcium is important. And that is where? In these myofibrils, because what does it allow the myofibril to do? To contract. Alright, so calcium is important not just for making strong bones, but for all muscle contraction. As a matter of fact, there is no muscle in your body that will contract without calcium. So now where do you think it's important to have calcium? In your muscles, for muscle contraction, or in your bones to make bones strong? If you had to choose one place or the other, you don't like that choice. Alright, your body has to make that choice, so I suppose you should make that choice too. I would choose muscles as well. Because what do you need muscles for? Well, for breathing, for eating, for moving around. All right, so when your body starts to run low on calcium, your body makes that same choice. Where does it get calcium to maintain proper muscle contraction? From your bones, because that's a reservoir, that's a storage place for calcium. And as we get older, of course, all of our bones get more brittle and thinner because calcium is needed in other parts of your body. For instance, for muscle contraction. All right, so what are some things that I want you to know? Well, you see a bunch of mitochondria here for making ATP. You have the sarcoplasmic reticulum. What's the job of the sarcoplasmic reticulum again? To store calcium and to release it when it is signaled by the electrical signal in the transverse tubule right here, which comes from the sarcolemma, which comes from the what, neuromuscular junction. And it causes the sliding of these filaments over each other, the actin and myosin myofilaments. Okay, so sometimes when you have the transverse tubule surrounded on either side by the SR, we call that a triad. So a triad is just two terminal cisternae of the sarcoplasmic reticulum running right through the middle is the transverse tubule. So that's a triad. The ends of the sarcoplasmic reticulum right here are sometimes what we call the terminal cisternae, and they're just loaded with calcium, ready to be released into the sarcomere so that the sarcomere can contract when the signal arrives. All right, so I don't know if this is an exam figure, but parts of this are, you know what, I'm sure it is an exam figure because it's so important to know the sarcoplasmic reticulum and what it contains and the transverse tubule right here. And that allows the electrical signal to excite way down deep inside each muscle cell. Okay. I'm going to go back a couple previous slides. Okay. No, maybe it was forward a couple. It was forward a couple. Right here. All right. So here is a nice zoomed in region of the neuromuscular junction. And here you can see calcium floating around in this myofibril. Where did this calcium come from that is floating around? It came from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And under what circumstances does the sarcoplasmic reticulum release calcium? When there is an electrical signal coming down the transverse tubule, right? And that electrical signal comes from these receptors right here. When they bind, acetylcholine causes that electrical signal. Okay. And acetylcholine, remember, was stored in these synaptic vesicles inside this end of an axon of a neuron. All right. So let me tell you one last thing. And that is, when an electrical signal comes down the neuron to the end of the axon right here, all right, it causes the fusion of these vesicles to, this is what we call the presynaptic membrane, because here's a synapse, here's the muscle membrane, the sarcolemma is the postsynaptic membrane, and then the synapse is, the synaptic cleft is the space between them. There's another signal, chemical signal, that is started when the electrical signal comes down the neuron that causes the fusion and release of neurotransmitter. So when an electrical signal comes down, it causes calcium that is outside the cell to enter, right, this axon terminus, and that calcium signal then causes the release of neurotransmitter, which then excites the muscle. So when we see information being transferred from the neuron into the muscle cell right here, we call this synaptic transmission. Right, synaptic transmission is when information goes from the neuron into the muscle, causing it to contract. Right, there an important ion that causes synaptic transmission is, and maybe you should draw it in on this slide, is what? Is also calcium. So put calcium on the outside of this swelling right here with an arrow going in. Right, so this blue line is the electrical signal causing calcium to enter the axon terminus, which then causes the release of neurotransmitter, which then causes more electrical signal to develop on the muscle. All right, so now you know a third important reason for calcium inside your body. What was the first one before taking this class? Bones, needing strong bones. What was the second one? Muscle contraction. Right, to get the sliding of the filaments over each other. But here's probably even another, even more important one. It's hard to say which is the most important. But what? Synaptic transmission. You need proper calcium outside these neurons to release neurotransmitter. So you would have no synaptic transmission. And what does synaptic transmission mean in your body? All conscious thought, okay? Anything that's controlling like your heart and nerve signals that control your heart require calcium as well. So all of these systems require calcium, and probably the least important place where you need calcium is where? Your bones. So when your body is depleted of calcium for all these important functions, guess where your body goes to find that calcium? Your bones. And then the downside of that is what? Osteoporosis, right? And that's, how can you fight osteoporosis? Having the three good important ways that you do that, by having proper calcium in your diet, foods that are high in calcium, but you need a vitamin to absorb that calcium into your body from your digestive tract, and that is vitamin D. So you need proper calcium, you need vitamin D, and then to make bones strong, how do you make bones strong? To take that calcium that's in your body and put it in that reservoir. What do you do to bones to make them strong? Exercise. Right, so those three things you got to do to prevent osteoporosis, you got to have proper diet, calcium and vitamin D, and also exercise. And that's really important before you get older. And in women, we call that menopause, and in men it's a little bit later than that, but still men can suffer from osteoporosis as well. Right, so diet and exercise is very important. All right, so we're not done with this chapter just yet. But I think we're going to stop right here and I think that's it. Even though on the lecture schedule, I think I only schedule one day, but I'll be able to finish up next time on Wednesday. All right, this information is not on the test. It's on the next test. It's on lecture test number 3. But go ahead and do all those nice pre-lecture reading assignments. After this chapter, we'll move on to the next chapter on Wednesday anyway, right away. And don't forget the sign-in sheet. Thank you so much.